At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
With the beginning of a new quarter, we are about to get hit by that once every 3 month flood of corporate profit reports we have come to know and love. Forget the actual number, though, profit or loss, and pay attention to their bank accounts. Corporations and cash on the broadcast today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At allybank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care associate 24/7.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Khan Rizdal. It is Monday, today the 4th of October. Good to have you here. You can expect lots of good corporate earnings numbers in the next couple of weeks. Not all of them, though, will be because of better sales. There have been cost cuts and layoffs and companies getting more out of the employees who are still working. And one other thing, too. Corporate America is sitting on piles of cash. Just today, Goldman Sachs cut its stock rating on Microsoft. A Goldman analyst said if it wants people to invest, the software company ought to bump up its dividend a little bit and start giving money back to shareholders. There are, though, other ways that companies can get rid of some of that cash, like hiring. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now from New York.
It's not just Microsoft that's hoarding cash. All the big companies are doing it. Just ask Howard Silverblatt, a senior analyst at Standard & Poor's.
6 months ago, they set another record. 3 months ago, they set another record, and they just did it again. 67 weeks of net income sitting in a bank, not earning a lot.
That's because companies remember what it's like not to have access to cash, and they're not going to spend what they have, he says, until there's plenty of demand for their products.
Before we get hiring, they're going to have to see their actual sales increase. So they know what they're going to produce, they'll be able to sell. Unfortunately, part of the cycle, consumers are not going to spend until they're sure that they have secure jobs.
And even President Obama doesn't expect consumers to break the cycle. He said today that a sharp consumer-driven recovery is unlikely because people, like companies, would rather build up their rainy day funds than spend. So if we're all doing the same thing, why are big companies expecting such hot earnings this quarter? I asked Dana Saporta, an economist at Credit Suisse.
Companies have done quite well to date because they've been cutting back on payrolls and saving money. But unless demand picks up, they will be in for hard times as well.
In other words, they can't cost cut their way to profit. At some point, she says, companies will have to start expanding to survive. When will that be? Saporta says it's probably several quarterly earnings seasons away. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
You know that triple mileage cash back platinum rewards card you like to use? Well, the stores where you use it actually don't like it so much. They probably sort of hate it, to be honest. That's because they pay card companies an extra hefty fee every time you whip it out. Those interchange fees, as they're known, were the subject of an antitrust settlement today between MasterCard and Visa and the Justice Department. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
The interchange fees merchants pay every time someone uses a credit card vary a lot, from around 1.5% of the total purchase to more than 3%. And usually, the fancier the card, the higher the fee.
The points don't expire.
There's no travel restrictions.
Points you can use for over a million rewards, including
those fees now cost merchants nearly $50 billion a year. And credit card companies haven't let merchants charge the triple mileage card user more for milk than the guy with the no perks card.
And the Department of Justice said you have to allow merchants
to offer their customers a discount if they use a cheaper card.
Mallory Duncan is with the National Retail Federation. He says Visa and MasterCard have also agreed to let merchants refuse certain cards. Used to be, if you took one kind of Visa, you took them all.
For merchants, it means they are beginning to push the card companies out of control of the cash register.
Duncan says now store owners can pass savings on to customers who use cards with lower fees.
Call me cynical, but I'm doubtful merchants are really going to be passing on cost savings to consumers.
Andrew Davidson researches credit cards for Mintel Compromedia. He thinks tiered pricing will be too much trouble for stores.
In terms of implementation, it's very complicated because is there going to be some sort of menu when you reach the cash register?
Davidson says people also like using their rewards cards, and merchants won't want to do anything to discourage people from spending. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Lest you think the European debt crisis is over, Greece announced another round of spending cuts and tax increases today. The government's trying to convince investors that its finances are finally under control. They do seem to have persuaded the Chinese. Over the weekend, Premier Wen Jiabao said he would be happy to buy Greek bonds, and he's going to put billions of dollars into Greek shipping companies while he's at it. More now from the European Bureau and Stephen Beard.
The Greeks were dismissed as feckless by some of their European partners earlier this year, but now the Chinese premier has paid tribute to their handling of the debt crisis. And he told the Greek government, if you want to sell more bonds, we'll buy them. But Tim Loinig of the London School of Economics urges the Greeks to take all this with a pinch of salt.
China is not buying Greek debt because it thinks it offers a great return. It's buying Greek debt because it thinks it will offer influence in the European community.
He says that by buying Greek and other European government bonds and supporting the euro, China hopes to gain even greater access to European markets and to receive fewer complaints about dumping underpriced products. Stephen King of HSBC Bank suspects another motive too. He believes China is trying to buy European support in its fight with the US over currency manipulation.
China now needs to find some friends in Europe, partly because of this tension with the US on the currency. And that means that by effectively lending to people who are desperate for money, it can make those friends.
But, says Steve Barrow, currency strategist with Standard Bank, the Europeans are not that desperate.
I don't think that whatever Chinese officials may say, that you'll see European politicians supporting the idea that currency should be fixed in this way.
He says that in spite of China's warm words about the Greeks and the euro, the Europeans will still accuse China of dumping and of currency manipulation. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Red arrows all the way around on Wall Street. Today we will have the details when we do the numbers. The first Nobel Prize of the year was announced this morning. Robert G. Edwards has won the Nobel for Medicine. Comes with a cash award of about $1.5 million, but the human and economic impact of his work has been much larger. In the 32 years since the world's first test tube baby was born, in vitro fertilization has become a multi-billion dollar industry, as Marketplace's Steve Hann reports.
More than 4 million babies have been born thanks to Edwards' research. It's made biological parenthood possible for same-sex couples and families who couldn't conceive. It's also created an enormous global industry.
Treatment of infertility in the United States alone generates billions of dollars.
Art Kaplan is director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Kaplan says despite the industry's size,
in vitro fertilization in the U.S. is completely unregulated. It's really a field that has grown according purely to market forces.
By some estimates, close to 15% of the world's population is infertile. Already, close to 3% of all live births in developed countries are possible because of IVF. And Kaplan thinks this is just the beginning.
In the future, with new genetic knowledge coming, what was a technology that once was only of interest to the infertile is going to become, in the 21st century, a technology that could be used to design our descendants.
There's already a market for elite egg donors. Deborah Spar is the president of Barnard College and the author of The Baby Business.
Generally, if you're talking about, quote, Ivy League eggs, we're talking anywhere between $10,000 and maybe $20,000, $25,000 per harvest.
Overall, there are few health guidelines for young egg donors, and there are often no guarantees for parents. I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
We've had economic booms and busts in the past decade. We've had floods and terrorist attacks. We have had creation and destruction in all of their extremes. Those forces are reflected by the buildings around us. So today on our series, The Art of Money, what artists and others see when they look at the economy, a conversation with Blair Kamen. He's the architecture critic at the Chicago Tribune. He's got a new book out about the last decade in American buildings. It's called Terror and Wonder. And when we spoke, I asked him how the past 10 years have changed the way we interact with those buildings.
When we went through airports, we now faced a corral-like atmosphere that was kind of like going through the old Chicago stockyards. We might go to a downtown and we would see a spectacular museum, a spectacle work of architecture. We would now see new green buildings with planted roofs and energy-saving materials. We started to concentrate after Katrina and the collapse of the levees in New Orleans on our infrastructure.
You make the point that it was defined, this decade in architecture was. It was defined on the vertical axis by the World Trade Center's coming down and this enormous tower, the Burj Dubai, the Burj Khalifa, I guess now properly, over in Dubai. Right. And also on the horizontal by the devastation of Katrina. I mean, it goes all ways.
The violence that Katrina and the terrorist attacks did was not only to cities and to people, but those disasters also did violence to our internal gyroscopes. I mean, we look at buildings and cities as kind of anchors, places of permanence amid the chaos of daily life. So it was incredibly unnerving, I think, to see those anchors, the Trade Center and the city of New Orleans, succumb to that very chaos.
You know, for all that September 11th brought to architecture and how we interact with buildings, you know, there were predictions that nobody would build any more big buildings, that we were done with skyscrapers. And that clearly, if you look at the Burj Khalifa over in Dubai at 2,700 feet, whatever it is, that hasn't happened.
Well, there were a lot of predictions made right after 9/11 that proved untrue. The skyscraper certainly didn't succumb to the terrorist attacks. In fact, the world went on the greatest skyscraper building boom in its history, with more skyscrapers, with more formal invention being built than any time in human history. The larger point here is that this building boom in large cities gave us what I call urbanization without urbanity, where there was an incredible surge of building, but there was also a cityscape that wasn't necessarily humane.
There was, at least in the early part of this decade that you write about, there was an exuberance out there. And it's exemplified best in your book and also in my daily commute practically by a building that's like two blocks from me right now, the Disney Concert Hall by Frank Gehry. I mean, that's an amazing structure. Are we done with those, though, now that the recession's here?
I think the age of the wow building, if it isn't over, is pretty much on the way out. Mm. It's not just that people don't have the money to do flashy, showy buildings. It's that in the middle of an economic downturn, they don't want to look flashy or showy. The culture, the atmosphere, the climate has changed. And that may not necessarily be a bad thing.
You end this collection of essays and columns on a note of policy and President Obama's efforts at infrastructure. And you say he's spreading asphalt and concrete like so much peanut butter across the country. Are we going to get a Hoover Dam out of this like they did in the Depression?
Not so far. We may get high-speed rail, but that's a long way down the road. So far, the stimulus, on the one hand, it is addressing the backlog of infrastructure that we let deteriorate. On the other hand, it is just spreading out billions of dollars into non-transformative infrastructure work, like the rebuilding of roads.
You call it the architecture of pragmatism.
Right. The sad thing is that, you know, we began this period with ruins, ruins that were created by an act of terrorism, and we're ending it with ruins. But these are the ruins of our infrastructure, our roads, our bridges. our architecture, as Louis Sullivan said, the great Chicago architect, our architecture reflects us as truly as a mirror. And we see that not only in our architecture, but in our public works as well.
Blair Kamen's book about architecture in our society and in our economy is called Terror and Wonder, Architecture in a Tumultuous Age. Blair, thanks a lot.
Kai, thank you.
Coming up, student scores or teacher success? Which one comes first?
Of all of my years of teaching, these last 8 to 10 years, I probably have done a better job than I've ever done before.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial sliced off 78 points this Monday, 0.7%, ended at 10,751. The NASDAQ walked off 26 points, about 1.1%, closed at 2344. The S&P 500 lost 9 points, 0.8%, finished at 1137. We told you about Goldman Sachs and its downgrade of Microsoft. The programmer stock dropped nearly 2% today. Other tech firms got caught in the downdraft. Apple lost 1.3%. Chipmaker AMD powered down 1.5% today. Financial shares traded mostly lower. Citigroup surrendered nearly 1.5%. American Express sank 6.5%. That after the Justice Department, as I mentioned, sued the company for allegedly violating antitrust laws over credit card acceptance rules. Sara Lee sweetened up more than 7% today after the New York Post reported the food maker got an unsolicited offer from KKR, the private equity firm. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Congressional Caucus on Homelessness holds a briefing to address veterans' homelessness. Educators, administrators, students, and others join Dr. Jill Biden for the first ever White House Summit on Community Colleges. And speaking of education, UNESCO marks World Teachers' Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
We're back. It's Marketplace, produced by American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This being the first Monday in October, the Supreme Court is back in session. The docket so far this term is loaded down with business-related cases, more than half of them to be precise. We'll be hearing from AT&T, Boeing, Walmart, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, to name but a few. Right now, we will also be hearing from Slate's Supreme Court correspondent, Dahlia Lithwick. Dahlia, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
What can we say 5 years into the Roberts Court about their feeling toward American business and American corporations?
Well, I think there's been a lot of chatter that this is a very comparatively pro-business court. Not just that big business tends to win more often than not, but, you know, there was an interesting statistic in the New York Times today that said they're actually also just really, really interested mm-hmm. in business. So 40 of the 51 cases on which the court has granted cert for this term have a corporation as a party.
That is to say the court's going to hear their cases, granted cert.
Yeah.
Let's go down the docket a little bit. The big one, or one of the big business cases this year, is this AT&T mobility case. It's AT&T versus Concepcion. It's all about this concept, really, of preemption, right? Explain that for us, would you?
Preemption sounds dreadful, but it's essentially just a doctrine that asks the question whether federal regulations are going to trump or preempt state regulations in a given case. There was a big preemption year 2 years ago on the docket. Court took a break last year, and this year they agreed to hear four preemption cases. So essentially, these become very, very interesting cases because they pit two very different conservative interests against one another. One is the states' rights group. There's another interest that is big business, and this is where the Chamber of Commerce comes in these cases, that say, no, we don't want the federalist or the states' rights argument to prevail here. What we want to have one consistent federal law that businesses know what to expect.
There are a couple of others. There's a whistleblower case. There's an immigration case out of Arizona. I mean, these are issues that sort of keep on coming up in front of the court, it seems, every year.
That's right. And the Arizona immigration case comes up again as a preemption case, as a question of whether the federal government has occupied the field in regulating this or whether the states have occupied the field. And it's an incredibly interesting case because it's a bellwether for how the court may look at the big Arizona immigration law that's in the pipeline. This is a narrower case. It essentially is about whether the state can sanction employers who hire illegals or whether the federal government is in charge of that kind of immigration policy. But I think it's going to give you a very, very good sense of where this court is looking at these big, big, big issues that are barreling down upon them, like the big Arizona immigration statute.
Is Elena Kagan going to change the balance in any of these cases?
Well, this is a very, very tricky area. As I said, the court agreed to hear four preemption cases. But Elena Kagan, because she was the Solicitor General for the Obama administration and she participated in the arguing and the briefing of these cases, has had to recuse herself in three out of the four cases. Hmm. Now, what that means is that she can't participate in these cases at all. And if these cases come out, as many suspect they will come out, 4-4 ties, then the lower court is simply affirmed. The Supreme Court has no opinion on this matter. And in these preemption cases where the corporations prevailed in the lower courts, what that means is at least for the short-term future, the corporations will have won these cases for a little while. Now, this isn't forever. This is just this term. But Kagan has recused herself in half of the cases that the Supreme Court has agreed to hear thus far this term.
Dahlia Lithwick, she covers the Supreme Court for Slate. Dahlia, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
This is Education Week for the Obama administration. The president's Economic Recovery Advisory Board met this morning. They were talking about private partnerships with community colleges. There's a big community college summit at the White House tomorrow afternoon. But a lot of the attention paid to education recently has been K through 12, specifically whether using kids' test scores is a fair way to grade teachers. There is some research out there that says test scores can be used with a bunch of other measurements to help find the most effective and least effective teachers at a given school. The problem is figuring out how to help the broad middle group be better teachers. A group of schools in Tennessee has proven that can be done, as Emily Hanford of American Radio Works reports.
About 10 years ago, education leaders in Chattanooga set out to fix the city's worst elementary schools, all of them in predominantly poor neighborhoods. Most students were making little or no progress on state tests. But in every school, there was at least one teacher whose students ended up doing better. Dan Challoner is a leader of the effort.
And that was a little bit of an aha moment, because when we realized that there was at least one great teacher in every school, it told us that the challenge now was to increase the number of great teachers so all kids can learn.
Their first move was to fire all the teachers, even the good ones, and make them reapply for their jobs. Then, with money from local foundations, they set out to attract new talent. They offered bonuses, mortgage deals, and free graduate school tuition. But in the end, the city schools didn't end up recruiting a whole new crop of teachers. More than two-thirds of the fired teachers got their jobs back. So Chattanooga's challenge was to figure out how to make those teachers better.
Real quick, what I need you to do is take out your journal, too.
Joe Curtis is one of the superstar teachers, whose students tend to make big gains on the tests.
And I need you on page 311. What page? 311.
Curtis has been teaching for nearly 30 years. Ask him how he became a good teacher, And he doesn't talk about graduate school or professional development days. He talks about other teachers, talking to them, trying out their methods, and watching them in action. It sounds like a simple idea, but in fact, most teachers don't get a chance to do this, at least not in a formal or ongoing way. That's changed in Chattanooga. Joe Curtis has been promoted to a new position called lead teacher. The principal arranges other teachers' schedules so they can watch Curtis teach.
Every time he gets up, I'm like, oh, that's a great way to approach that. You know, you just don't think of it.
Heather Long is a new teacher. Not only does she watch Curtis teach, he watches her and gives feedback and advice. They also plan lessons together. Curtis works with the veterans in his building, too. Everything teachers in Chattanooga do now is rooted in the idea that they get better when they work together. That's a radical change, says Penny King, who's taught here for 26 years.
You just did your own thing, and you didn't want anybody to find out what you were doing or how you were doing it. And if your kids were successful, that was good, but you weren't going to tell them. Because you didn't want them to know how your kids were so good because it was a competition. And now it's not a competition. Now it's a team.
King says she and her colleagues have learned all kinds of new teaching techniques. One thing they've learned, don't lecture at the students. Their goal now is to get the kids thinking and talking. All the teachers I spoke with say they're better than they were. Here's Linda Land.
Of all of my years of teaching, these last 8 to 10 years, I probably have done a better job than I've ever done before.
And indeed, the teachers are doing a better job according to the measure that matters most these days, test scores. Before the initiative, teachers in Chattanooga's worst city schools were far less effective at raising student test scores than teachers at suburban schools. 6 years later, teachers at the city schools were more effective than their colleagues in the suburbs. For Dan Challoner and others working in Chattanooga, the lesson is that teachers can get better. He says just firing them is not the way to go.
Yes, there were some teachers there who weren't doing nearly what they needed to do. But the issue was raising the skill level and the effectiveness of the large group of teachers we had.
Challoner believes most teachers in America today are satisfactory or good, and the key is to make them better. He doesn't think Chattanooga has all the answers, but he says giving teachers the chance to collaborate and learn from each other is crucial to helping them improve. I'm Emily Hanford for Marketplace.
Emily's reporting is part of an American Radio Works documentary called Testing Teachers. You can hear more of her interviews and the whole documentary, in fact, on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact Email Marketing, providing small businesses and nonprofits with personal coaches to help them succeed. ConstantContact.com. And by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit Putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, an observation of what can happen when gold hits new highs, $1,313 an ounce today. The thing about this rally, though, is that people are buying actual gold instead of futures contracts or mining company stocks. And when you buy real gold, you need a place to put it, which means gold vaults are now big business. JPMorgan Chase has opened up a vault that closed 20 years ago in the last rally. It's got hundreds of tons of gold in storage. There is apparently a limit, though. A vault built in 1902 for John Pierpont Morgan, as in J.P. Morgan, can't be used anymore. It's been turned into a restaurant in New York. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow gave up 78 points, about 0.7%. The NASDAQ off 26 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 lost 9 points, 0.8%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this broadcast, how economics drives all sorts of human behavior, including in baseball.
There's probably more of an emphasis in the post-steroid era of players that have speed and defense as a primary attributes rather than hitting, slugging, hitting home runs.
A new segment, Freakonomics Radio, on Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. I do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.